But he wasn't a song leader. It wasn't until another 3 years that Guy Carawan made it famous.
The late folk singer and activist Pete Seeger speaking in 2004. He was born 100 years ago today. You can watch that full interview and all of our interviews with Pete Seeger on our website, democracynow.org. You can also sign up for our daily email, our headlines and news alerts. Yeah, just text the word Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. That's Democracy Now, 66866. Democracy Now! Has an immediate opening for our paid full-time digital fellowship here in New York City. We also are accepting applications for paid six-month internships. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? When floodwaters reach your door? When wildfires are engulfing the edge of your neighborhood, or an earthquake is destroying buildings. When a tornado is tearing through town, or a hurricane strikes, or is the best time perhaps today? During a disaster, you may not be able to stay in touch with your family or friends as easily as you think. And it's not always as simple as using your cell phone. That's why now is the time to take action. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Please join WHFR.FM 89.3 for Blues Music on Highway 61, Friday 2 till 4 p.m. Each week, DJ Kitty Love brings the best in new blues releases in Detroit blues to Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thanks so much for being with us this Friday afternoon as we continue our exploration of things going on here in the Dearborn community, Metro Detroit, and here on the HFC campus. Today on our program, we bring you another edition of Mirror News Now, our ongoing collaboration with the Mirror News, Henry Ford College's student newspaper. Your host for the hour is creative editor of the paper and HFC student, Justin Randles.
Thank you. Welcome back to another edition of the Mirror News Now. I'm your host, Justin Randles. Mirror News Now is the show where we expand on stories in HFC's student-ran paper, the Mirror News. This is the last show of the winter semester, and it is packed with some great stuff. First up, we have Madison Fetterman, who did a report on the Detroit incinerator.
On March 27th, Detroit Renewable Energy permanently closed the incinerator. According to CEO Todd Grzek, the facility was too old and the cost to eliminate odors too high. The facility employed about 150 workers. Mayor Mike Duggan said the city will work with laid-off employees to find new jobs. The facility received more than 3,000 tons of garbage every day from Metro Detroit communities and Canada. Hundreds of complaints have been filed with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality about the poor air quality near the incinerator. Last spring, the grassroots campaign called Breathe Free Detroit collected over 15,000 signatures calling for the city to close the incinerator and presented them to Mayor Mike Duggan. Last December, I interviewed Katie Andreski, coordinator of Breathe Free Detroit.
When and by whom was Breathe Free Detroit established?
So it's hard to say the exact starting date. About 2 years ago, Breathe Free Detroit was established through EMEAC, the East Michigan Environmental Action Council. And I wasn't on board then. I just got pulled on board full-time in August. And
so, okay.
But I've been working to end the incinerator since I moved here in 2007. For the past 2.5 years, this campaign is all about, we're going to shut it down. And in that process, we're, you know, really great questions come up from the community and from the workers. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going to happen to my job?
Right.
What's going to happen to my neighborhood when this shuts down? Am I going to be bought out of my house? And, you know, where is my job going to go? Are you going to create other jobs that are going to be union jobs? Mm-hmm. So we're coming, this coming year, we're really addressing that. What does just transition mean for these folks? How do we work with unions? How do we work with the workers? How do we create examples mm-hmm. of processes that work? Because, you know, it's in the incinerator, shutting an incinerator down and going towards a recycling program, it has solid examples within the United States that it increases jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just recycling alone increases jobs tenfold.
Yeah.
If you include entities that'll bring in, you know, your products that don't work anymore and fix them, mm-hmm. you can increase jobs and and also create a composting facility. The jobs increase 10 times, or 100 times rather, as much instead of just 10 times.
Right.
So there's a lot that can be done, but it's, you know, what we're capable of as a small grassroots organization is more trying to push and educate the agenda. We don't necessarily have the steam to, you know, create and pass the agenda. So, you know, there's always a balance.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So, in what ways does the organization bring the community together?
Yeah, so, well, that's been a little bit of a struggle since I've started.
Is
how do we get people involved in this? And, of course, I've only been here since August.
Yes.
It's been, you know, there's an influx of people that come out when it's really important. And so we have right now 600 people on our mailing list. We have over 1,000 people on our Facebook page that are wanting to stay informed. You know, right now this campaign is serving a community that's majority Black. And our core right now is like half Black, half white. But we want it to reflect what it actually looks like
right.
for the neighborhood. So in the next few months, I'm going to be dropping in at every neighborhood community meeting and presenting what this is all about, mm-hmm. asking folks if they want to be part of the strategy in, you know, making this happen, and allowing them to have a seat at the table in the decision-making process.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so it's we're going to be really developing what that is. And a lot of our strategy is also based off of the environmental justice principles and mm-hmm. the Hamas principles, and so we always try to resort back to them. What are we doing well? What do we need to strengthen? And so even though I am part of the community, that I'm still like my in it, so we're working on figuring out how do we best create a better structure that involves community engagement.
Okay.
We do a lot of strange events. We have potlucks, we had a kite flying event, we had a party in October that we had a screen printing where they were making t-shirts, and then we also had an artist come that was helping paint a big sign for us, and at the same time we had live music and spoken word and people signing you up to vote, and so there were a lot of different groups that came together for that event. So we try to do a little bit of everything that, you know, different people would want
right.
to come to. And we just recently had a town hall, which was, and that a lot of that was broadcasted live on Facebook,
yeah.
so you can even watch the whole thing.
Yeah, I actually went to that one.
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're familiar. It was rainy. I was expecting more people.
Yeah.
But it was more of a town hall for folks that have already been doing this work mm-hmm. and have seen the success in it. And we wanted to do that because it was in connection with the Gaia Zero Waste Academy that was happening that weekend. Mm-hmm. So they had invited all these people out from out of town, which allowed us to put them on a platform to be able to speak to city officials.
All right. So what are the specific effects of the incinerator on the people living near it? And do you have any stories you've heard from Detroiters in your community that have really left a lasting impression on you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. So there's a lot of toxins that come out of the incinerator, and the ones that are very concerning are the NOx, the nitrous oxides that cause mm-hmm. asthma. So there's a huge rate of asthma in this area. It's 3 times higher than anywhere else in Michigan, and it's so that's a huge problem. Also, dioxins are caused from burning plastics, and they can settle in the soil and in the ground and on the windowsills, and those are, you know, carcinogenic. And mercury, and you know, just there's so many. So
yeah.
But I think the most impactful comment that I heard from one of my neighbors is they moved into the neighborhood a little bit after I did, and they have 2 young girls, and they used to live in Southwest Detroit, and when they moved there, and literally like we're about a mile, like a bird's eye mile from the incinerator east of it, and he had mentioned how, you know, he didn't have any breathing problems before he moved. Now he has like respiratory issues. His daughter had never had asthma before they moved. Now they have that here. There's like, he has a lot of like rashes that also happen, which I haven't heard from anybody else, but you know, he really blames the air quality and just the stress around being there.
Right.
So, but it's hard. The biggest problem in our fight is that we cannot really specify that the incinerator is the issue. It's surrounded by highways. You know, there's the U.S. Ecology is there with hazardous waste, you know, removal, and there's so many other problematic sites that are around the incinerator that, you know, we know it doesn't help.
Right.
So it's hard to say this is the only one, and if we, you know, take that down, then the neighborhood's gonna be great. But, you know, it's a larger fight than
that. Yeah. So what does Breathe Free Detroit mean to you specifically?
I'd say that, I mean, that's kind of a hard question. it's my job. let's see. Like, one of the reasons why I'm really proud to work for Breathe Free Detroit is because I want a better future for all the kids that grow up in that neighborhood. I came from teaching in Detroit Public Schools before
really?
I received this position. And so one of my main focuses for the past 8 years in education was to increase health and sustainability to some of the worst off populations in Detroit and Hamtramck. So I, when this came about, like, it's not only rewarding that idea of, you know, my whole intention of what I do from my heart, but it also, it hits close to home because now it's for my neighborhood. You know, I was,
yeah.
Before I was going out to Henry Ford High School on Evergreen 8 Mile or Osborne Deep, like 7 Mile on Gratiot or like the Hamtramck housing projects. And it, like, so I would always reach out to these other communities, and now it's something that's more focused on mine. So it's really, yeah, it's a perfect piece in that.
Yeah. How has this campaign changed the way you see racial and socioeconomic disparities, environmental or otherwise, in Metro Detroit and nationwide?
Yeah, well, it's a clear example of environmental racism.
Yeah.
And it's extremely clear. It's so clear that, like, the BBC reporter has contacted us and wants to just do a story about how obvious it is. I mean, the majority of the trash that's coming in is from a more well-off white suburbs of Detroit, and they a lot of times are completely unaware that this is what's going on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's even in the raising of awareness, there's no change in that. And so, you know, the people that are mostly affected by the negative effects of pollutants that come out of this facility because of other people's trash are poor and black communities. And so it's after learning so many other environmental justice communities in Detroit, it's all, you know, poor and people of color communities, and it's not, this is no way to have a society. You know, mm-hmm. there's one, we shouldn't be polluting as much because we just can't afford to live yeah. like this any longer. And if we do need to pollute, it should be in smaller amounts and in wider areas, because, you know, it should be something that we should all take the toll of, so that we can all understand the effects of it, so we can't just throw something away and just see it go away and not think about it again. It's really frustrating to see that, and it's almost disempowering, because a lot of the times these places end up in, these facilities end up in these places because everybody that lives there is feeling so disempowered already.
Yeah.
Like, they have enough problems with their health, or they have enough problems with their finances, or, you know, keeping their house together, that these are people that are not going to take the time to stand up and say, wait a second, I don't want this in my neighborhood. And so there's, it's kind of like the, like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? What do you do? Shut down the facility, or help, like, make sure that these areas of society don't have it that hard, so that they
right.
can make sure that there's, you know, that chance for them to stand up and share their voice.
So what are some things that everyday people can do to get involved with and help mm-hmm. your campaign?
All right, well, I said earlier that, you know, every time you recycle,
yeah,
it's one act, you know, you'd be proud of yourself, I'm not incinerating this, and every time you compost as well. If anybody wants to become, you know, a larger part of our campaign, make sure to email me or contact me like you are now. We try to have monthly events.
Yeah.
Things are kind of structurally changing right now because I'm going to be going out to a lot of community meetings instead of asking them to come together for monthly events. But like us on Facebook, anytime we post stuff, to repost it, that's really helping a lot of the reporting that's going on the outside. So what we do, we try to keep the reporters engaged, because then when the reporters put a story out there, that's when all of a sudden people are whispering into the ears of the mayor, city council, you know, and new state legislation and all of that. So
okay,
yeah,
all right. And then, do you have any final comments?
Let's see. If you live close to the incinerator, you definitely have to call the phone number if there's any smell of odor.
Okay.
Because every time an order is reported, it actually goes into a list in MDEQ, and when they have enough of them, they actually fine them for it. So every fine that they receive helps them realize that it's going to be more expensive for them to continue the operations. This is a global movement. It's not just isolated here, and that's something that's really special, that we're a part of Gaia now, which is the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. I just was in Florence, Italy, meeting with Mothers Against Incineration, and it's everybody's going through the same issues, but we're getting to this point where we're all starting to connect and share strategy, and it's really beautiful because for the past 10 years of fighting this thing, I'm like, nobody has a trash burning facility in their town, but there's quite a few.
Yeah.
So if people do want to get involved and they understand that it's a larger issue than just Detroit.
Detroit Renewable Energy came under new ownership in December when New York-based Basalt Infrastructure Partners took over as the majority partner, and New Jersey-based DCO Energy, a minority partner, took over operations. The new ownership assumed responsibility for all permits as well as outstanding judgments and orders. In January, the Citizen Groups, Environmental Michigan, the Ecology Center, and the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center filed an intent to sue letter to the owners and operators of the Detroit incinerator for violating the Clean Air Act. In announcing the closure of the incinerator, Detroit Renewable indicated that energy generated from the incinerator will now be handled by Detroit Thermal, a natural gas company near Ford Field and subsidiary of Detroit Renewable Power. The trash that went to the incinerator will now be sent to area landfills. This has been Madison Fetterman reporting for the Mirror News at Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan.
What a great story. That was Madison Fetterman with her story on the Detroit incinerator. We'll be back with more after the break. This is the Mirror News Now from Henry Ford College.
Housing discrimination. Would you recognize it and report it? These folks did.
My landlord said rent will be cheaper if we're friends with benefits.
Because I'm legally blind, a landlord questioned whether I'd be capable of maintaining an apartment.
Our real estate agent said a different neighborhood with people like us might better suit our family.
To learn more about housing discrimination, visit hud.gov/fairhousing. Fair housing is your right. Use it. A public service message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
As an 18-year-old, I let my mistakes kind of take over my life. I was 0.5 credits away from completing high school, and I didn't do it.
10 years later, at age 28, Jackie finished her high school diploma.
When I found out that I was pregnant, I know that I had to do something for myself if I wanted to make her a better person and provide a better life for her. My family never stopped pushing for me to be better because they knew what I could become and who I could become as a person. My support team is amazing. The educational director, my sister, and even my 7-year-old daughter has just been more than the support that I could ask for. I've been given an opportunity, and I'm just thankful for it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
This is Sam the Saxman. Join me every Monday, 2 to 4 p.m. on WHFR 89.3 FM, where we go for a panoramic view of music. I seek to find the story behind the artist and maybe some history that even I or you have not ever heard of about a certain artist. From Mozart to Memphis, the Stone Age to the Stones, crooners, mooners, and sooners in June, I will do my best to bring you quality programming in the tradition of WHFR. Please tune in every Monday, 2 to 4 WHFR, and you can live stream us off of our website. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Mazurek, and it's the WHFR Journal this afternoon here on the station Making Waves. On our program today, another edition of Mirror News Now. Our host for the program is the creative editor of the Mirror News, Henry Ford College's student newspaper, and also HFC student Justin Randles.
Thank you. This is Justin Randles with Mirror News Now. Next up, we have Mirror News reporter Olivia Grantham investigating services that Henry Ford College provides for students to help them on their journey through their education.
Henry Ford College provides several services to assist students to complete their classes and programs. I spoke with Chardine Claiborne, coordinator of the Learning Lab and Tutoring Services, about some of the ways his department helps students.
What does the Learning Lab do in particular to help these students? I know you brought up the classes that are offered, but is there anything else?
Yeah, another thing that we do is we try to really get the word out about what we do because I'm amazed at how many students either don't know about us or haven't used us. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we do is we invite faculty to come and bring their classes, mm-hmm. and we tour them around our mm-hmm. space and explain to them exactly all that we can offer. Mm-hmm. I and my staff, and sometimes even our tutors, will go into classrooms to tell classes mm-hmm. what we do mm-hmm. and about our services and invite mm-hmm. them to come and use us. Mm-hmm. I give workshops to different populations, mm-hmm. and I'm always open to doing more. Two of the populations that use me the most, I would say, are champs, the student athletes.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
They have me come and talk with them mm-hmm. About different subject matters that mm-hmm. are kind of under that umbrella of mm-hmm. learning strategies mm-hmm. or study skills. Mm-hmm. I also work a lot with the nursing students mm-hmm. who are trying to prepare for their admissions tests mm-hmm. and getting them prepared with test-taking mm-hmm. skills and strategies. Mm-hmm. I also do a lot of one-on-one mm-hmm. work with students who mm-hmm. may need some help with, you know, reading comprehension or test-taking strategies mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think with the tutoring, the workshops, the individualized instruction
yeah.
appointments, those are the greatest number of things that mm-hmm. we do.
Mm-hmm.
And again, none of these services cost a student any additional funds,
right.
but it is tied into their tuition and their fees.
According to a Brookings study, fewer than 40% of community college students earn a certificate or degree within 6 years of enrollment.
Do you think this is applicable to HSC or no? Do you think like we're better, worse?
I think our graduation rate right now is at 6%. So it's pretty low.
Yeah. Is graduation like here you just get the degree that you work for? Like, what is that
quality? Yeah, so complete, and again, this is one of those things that can be the definer is the person who is making the definition.
Yeah.
And it depends on, like, if you're talking to a certain accrediting agency, mm-hmm. you know, if you're just talking within your institution, mm-hmm. all these things can determine how you're defining. So mm-hmm. we talk about things like success. Mm-hmm. We talk about things like retention. Mm-hmm. We talk about things like completion or mm-hmm. graduation. Mm-hmm. So all these things can mean different things to a different person depending mm-hmm. on who's doing the asking and the telling. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about completion and graduation, mm-hmm. we're generally talking about students who either earn their certificate or mm-hmm. their degree mm-hmm. from the institution, mm-hmm. or a student who transfers and goes on, you know, later on to earn a degree there. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about here at Henry Ford, we are working to do a better job of graduating our students, mm-hmm. you know, helping them to be successful, mm-hmm. Retaining those students who are new here who may be at risk for whatever reason mm-hmm. so that they can complete. But the reality is that completion, success, retention, all these things are a problem overall, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not just a Henry Ford College mm-hmm. issue. Mm-hmm. It's something that many campuses are struggling with. Mm-hmm. And so each population of students at a campus is individual. Mm-hmm. And so it's up to that institution to determine what are the things that we need to do mm-hmm. to help our students be successful. Mm-hmm. I think Henry Ford is doing that in a lot of good ways. One thing that we're doing is we're looking at how we can get those students who may be close, mm-hmm. meaning like 45 credits or more mm-hmm. already mm-hmm. earned, and seeing how we can help them to return to the institution mm-hmm. and finish so mm-hmm. that they can be mm-hmm. completers, so that mm-hmm. they can be graduates mm-hmm. or successful transfers. Mm-hmm. We're looking to see, you know, as I mentioned, socioeconomic. We know that, you know, many of our students who come to Henry Ford are disadvantaged in mm-hmm. some ways. And that's not the best way to look at a student. Mm-hmm. We want to look at it from an asset model mm-hmm. and not a deficit. But we mm-hmm. have to also understand that not all students come in, and that the playing field is not always level,
yeah.
so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at how can we help those students who are coming in with the most disadvantages receive the greatest support mm-hmm. so that they can move forward mm-hmm. and try to be... you know, champions of equity mm-hmm. and help things, help those students be mm-hmm. successful. Mm-hmm. So Henry Ford is not turning a blind eye mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to these issues.
Right.
And I do know that at our level, I'm a faculty member, but also at the higher levels of the institution, our vice presidents, mm-hmm. our president, mm-hmm. you know, our board members, I know that they are all concerned with our low retention rate, our low mm-hmm. completion rate, mm-hmm. and it's something that if you talk to anyone, you'll hear them say that retention is everyone's problem. It's, mm-hmm. it's everyone's concern, mm-hmm. you know. And so, multiple factors, multiple people on campus are working on this mm-hmm. issue.
Okay. I believe I have one more question. So, when you got do you reach out to failing and at-risk students, or do they have to come to you for the different resources that you offer here or just around campus?
So I think what generally happens is we try to use the available, how can I explain it? I guess there's different ways of reaching out. Mm-hmm. So students generally hear about us at the beginning through orientation.
Right.
That's the mm-hmm. first time.
Mm-hmm.
then, like I said, in terms of reaching the student body, we either have to use the marketing
right.
at our disposal.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Mirror News,
mm-hmm.
this will be good. That's
mm-hmm.
a student, that's kind of to students.
Mm-hmm.
So they may read that. We put flyers up around campus. We put, you know, table tents up in areas that students seem to congregate.
Mm-hmm.
We do our outreach by going to different different classrooms and having them come to us. There's no... Students get a lot of email.
Yeah, and so I know a lot of people don't check their email here, though.
And I've been informed that that's not the best way to
yeah.
to reach students.
Yeah.
And so we really can't do email blasts
right.
or things like that. So what we're working on, one other thing that we're working on right now as an office is a newsletter
mm-hmm.
to try to get that in the hands
oh,
of students and help
okay.
them understand more about what we do and showcase
mm-hmm.
you know what we can do for them. But the outreach is probably one of the most difficult parts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how other departments
mm-hmm.
are reaching out to
mm-hmm.
at-risk students.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the college talked about at one time,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure where it is right now, was the creation of an early alert or an early warning system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so what was to happen is students who were at risk at a class during a certain point in the semester, so let's say right around midterm,
mm-hmm.
faculty members would enter this information about
mm-hmm.
that student into the system,
mm-hmm.
And then the person who was in charge of that overall system would kind of route those messages
mm-hmm.
to the department.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say a faculty member says, you know, Olivia is
mm-hmm.
having a problem. I've
mm-hmm.
spoken with her. She's not at where we would think she should be. She's like at a C or below,
mm-hmm.
or below a C
mm-hmm.
right now. Then that person would maybe reach out to me and say, well, maybe she needs tutoring.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the faculty member thought that maybe you needed counseling,
mm-hmm.
to reach out to counseling, to
mm-hmm.
reach out
oh,
to you.
Okay.
So it's supposed to create a centralized structure,
okay.
a centralized place where the class, the faculty teaching the classes, or anyone who may be in contact with the student
mm-hmm.
can put in this system these concerns,
mm-hmm.
and then those could be routed
mm-hmm.
to the correct person.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I'm not sure where that went or what's
mm-hmm.
happening with that now,
mm-hmm.
or if there's any plans to, you know, start that up again.
Mm-hmm.
But that was to be sort of the cattle catcher,
yeah.
so to speak.
Yeah.
So I think that will be, and I know that's something that's been used at many institutions.
Yeah.
I think that's something that can be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that something like that will be implemented here. We've talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
We've tried a couple pilots before,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure where it is now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, that's like, I think that would be very helpful. So, I mean, that's a cool, like, plan, I guess, or a good idea. But, yeah, I believe that is all. Those are all the questions I have. So, thank you.
That was Olivia Grantham interviewing Chardine Claiborne. To further the story, Olivia interviewed the Assistant Director of Assisted Learning Services, who provides more insight on the challenges that students face.
Some students require more specialized assistance. I spoke with Dr. Maureen Webster, counselor with Assisted Learning Services, and discussed issues that students may face that can impact their success.
So, I'm pretty much just interviewing you to see what you do in terms of failing or at-risk students. And I know Mr. Claiborne was talking to me about how at-risk like can mean different things. Like it's not necessarily failing, but like different kind of environmental factors are taken into account, I guess, like when you're evaluating what makes an at-risk student. So what do you do in terms of students that are failing or that are kind of approaching failing, like at-risk?
We work with a little more specialized population, students
mm-hmm.
who have diagnosed disabilities.
Oh, okay.
So I would primarily be seeing students who
came in and were on probation and needed to see a counselor. Because I'm one of the counselors here, but my assignment is in the office called Assisted Learning Services.
Okay.
Now, I do see students from outside of that population as well, and I welcome anyone that wants to see me, but my primary responsibility is to try to help the students that initially come in with some kind of documentation saying they have a disability, and it could range from a visual impairment, hearing issue, learning disability, psychiatric issue. I have a lot of students that have anxiety. A person could be autism spectrum disorder classified. So I work with them in a variety of ways. I set up accommodations for them. Accommodations would be, let's say, for a hearing impaired student, an interpreter. For a visually impaired student, it might be learning how to use some of the software that reads information, helps scan information. Other students may be referred to the learning lab for additional tutoring. Sometimes they need to test down here with extra time. Also, we can ask the instructors to find note takers for them to help them be more successful. So that's just a list of some of the accommodations. But Olivia, you're targeting more in the at-risk area and the probationary student area, it sounds like. So I would be one of the support areas that a student who is on probation might be referred to. In other words, let's say another counselor who works in the general area, which is just down the hall, has a student who's already on probation, but that student says, you know, in high school I had a lot of extra help and I was able to take tests in a special room, extra time. I think if I had that, I might be able to do better in my classes. So that counselor would process this probationary information the person has to process, like to lift the hold so that person can register for classes, then I would try to set that person up with some extra services here. Now, when you ask about at-risk, like Mr. Claiborne said, some of the at-risk students might be at-risk economically. They might be at-risk because they don't have a stable home environment. You know, maybe they're starting to get kicked out of their house or they're homeless. So if it's an issue like that, we can also work with financial aid and with the lady right next door, Dr. Hildreth, who can assist also in finding shelter for them. And she has an emergency fund that helps to fund some of the basics, like maybe they need some gas money or they broke their glasses or something that's preventing them from, you know, coming back and taking class or being successful. So other at-risk students might be those who had poor preparation in high school. I would simply look at test scores and see what we could do to get that person college ready. Maybe take some review classes in English or math. Mention that the tutoring is something that person should, you know, really be going to on a regular basis, and show them a schedule in the learning lab that they could fit into their life. Other at-risk issues, you know, like I'd say, might be unstable relationships. I could try to provide personal counseling to get that person in a better place or, you know, in a little more stability. So, you know, like I say, depending on what the risk is, it might even be referring that person to our Hawk's Nest for food, the food bank there. I'd also try to find referral agencies outside of Henry Ford if that person needed long-term therapy or needed medical treatment or some kind of diagnosis for other issues. There are places like U of D, Mercy, and Wayne State that actually will do some testing to see what kind of issues a person is having. Maybe the person has a learning disability and didn't realize it before, so try to get that person some extra testing and some services here that we could set up. So I've been kind of giving my little spiel. Maybe you want to jump in if you have questions about...
When students come here and they come to you after finding out they're on probation, do you already know the struggles, I guess, that they're facing, or do you assess them here with them and, like, then talk about, like, why maybe they could be failing or why they're on probation, and then you send them somewhere else?
Yeah, good question, and it's a combination. if I have seen that student a number of times,
okay,
I will already know that student is struggling. Mm-hmm. I might have referred that person to the learning lab. Mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. might have already cautioned the person not to take 15 minutes of work full time. Uh-huh. And I would never say, I told you so. Uh-huh. But I would say, you know, we've got to look seriously at what you can do. You're mm-hmm. very capable, but you took on a little too much. So
right.
let's look at what's important and economically what you need to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see what we can do differently here. Mm-hmm. So if I have a long history with that student, then I'll already know perhaps some of the things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tracking system. So electronically, when a student comes in, I'll track a brief note. You know, signed up for these classes, went for tutoring. I don't put a lot of personal information in mm-hmm. there, but something mm-hmm. so that I can remember next time I see the student
yeah.
that he was having trouble in English 132
mm-hmm.
or that he was working a lot and mm-hmm. really had too many credits. So I'll have a feeling for that person.
Mm-hmm.
If the person only met with me one time in the very beginning of her time at Henry Ford, and I haven't seen her for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and she comes in, I'll say, oh, yeah, how you doing? I haven't seen you. And,
yeah.
Then maybe I find out that she went through a divorce, or
mm-hmm.
you know, one of her children were seriously ill, or you
mm-hmm.
know, I'll try mm-hmm. to find out about personal things that I can't
yeah.
see on a computer screen.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyone that comes in is going to sit with me, and I'm going to go over all of their classes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to look at what they need for their degree.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about what happened that semester,
mm-hmm.
what the person's tried. So I do kind of a diagnostic assessment when the person
mm-hmm.
comes in. But if I know the person, I may have a feeling, oh, it really was tough this last semester. I know you went through some problems. So
mm-hmm.
Are you getting some support? Do you have friends that
yeah.
you can talk to, or
mm-hmm.
do you have anyone at home that understands?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so try to see if that person's going to be in a good place or what I can do to get that person
yeah.
back on track. So
okay.
combination of looking ahead
yeah.
at what I can see visually. But, you know, sometimes there's a life event
yeah.
that person doesn't really want to share,
mm-hmm.
and it's really made a difference in the performance that semester.
Right.
So, you know, I'll try to gently explore that.
Yeah.
Now, anyone coming in doesn't have to reveal everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to develop some kind of rapport with the person,
mm-hmm.
but if that person has something that's really private and doesn't want to go there, then I'll look at educationally what we can do to try to get back on track
mm-hmm.
and see if that person has other issues that he or she wants to discuss. I welcome that person to come back.
Mm-hmm.
I'll even set up another appointment right here and
mm-hmm.
say, now, why don't you tell me next week how this is working, or try the learning lab, give me some feedback on whether that tutor was helpful
mm-hmm.
to you.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a question of instructor,
mm-hmm.
have you emailed the instructor, do you know how you're doing this semester, and
mm-hmm.
try to give that person some strategies
mm-hmm.
so he can figure out how to raise up that grade
yeah.
point average.
Yeah, okay.
Does that answer your question,
yes.
Olivia?
Yes, yes, it does. Is there a certain length of time that students are on probation? Like, how do you get off of it? Once you're on?
You're on it for a semester.
Oh, okay.
You're on it for
okay.
that particular semester.
Oh, okay.
And then after this semester, registration will assess again
mm-hmm.
your grade point average. And if after the grades are in for that
mm-hmm.
semester,
mm-hmm.
you're back on at a 2.0 or higher,
mm-hmm.
then you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean two semesters down the road, you might not fall back on probation again. So you
mm-hmm.
can be on and off probation,
mm-hmm.
but it's done by a semester basis.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So if your grades are improved,
mm-hmm.
then you'll be off probation.
Mm-hmm.
When you retake a class, only the highest grade point average is computed. So
okay.
if I fail English 131 and go back, get the greatest teacher, work my brains out, and get an A,
yeah.
I've got a 4.0 for that class.
Oh, okay.
So that E is not going to be computed. It
okay.
still will show up on my transcript,
mm-hmm.
but the highest grade will be computed.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
that's kind of nice.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's as simple as retaking a class or
mm-hmm.
two, then that may be all the student needs to
mm-hmm.
get off probation
mm-hmm.
and in good standing.
Okay.
If it's a major thing, like a lot of classes failed, and a question of the person being in the wrong program that wasn't a good fit,
mm-hmm.
that person may say, hey, I don't want to take anatomy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I hated the class. I was going to go into nursing.
Yeah.
I really don't want to go to nursing. I'm going to do graphic design.
Yeah.
That person's not going to go back and retake the bio 233.
Yeah.
That person's going to be working against the tide. In
mm-hmm.
other words, taking art 102 drawing and 101 design and mm-hmm. trying to get high grades in that to offset mm-hmm. an E, let's say, in an anatomy class. So mm-hmm. that might take longer.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe the person's on probation for a couple semesters, but mm-hmm. as soon as they hit 2.0, registration is going to get all the person's back.
Yeah. Okay. So students are, like, after they're on probation, they're more likely to come off of probation than just... Do people just stop coming once on probation and just kind of give it up, or do they keep working?
I'd say the majority of people I see that are on probation persist.
Okay.
Unless they have just failed everything.
Yeah.
And then a lot of times they're discouraged.
Uh-huh.
And maybe they picked the wrong classes. They started out with too much. It was their first semester.
Yeah.
And they just really had a tough time.
Yeah.
You know, I call students sometimes if I see that they've had a tough time. I don't get their grades, but if, you know, they're talking to me and saying I'm failing everything, I'll try to encourage them to come back and have a fresh start.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they will be allowed to come back once they're on probation.
Yeah.
Usually after a year, their financial aid is impacted because if they're brand new students, the financial aid office usually waits for the whole year before they start checking grade point averages.
Mm, okay.
Unless they failed everything, then they've got to sometimes refund money
mm-hmm.
or make a really good appeal
mm-hmm.
and document mm-hmm. how long they've been here.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of complications with financial aid too, but brand new students who really have a tough time often have a whole year in which to kind of get back on track.
Thank you.
That was Olivia Grantham interviewing Dr. Maureen Webster with Assisted Learning Services. Next up, Olivia interviews Mary Kosmowski, the counselor who runs the Inside Track Peer Mentoring Program.
In addition to professional support provided by counselors like Dr. Webster, the college provides peer mentors. I spoke to Mary Kosmowski, who coordinates the Inside Track Peer Mentor Program.
One of my main mission is to get word out about this program.
Mm-hmm.
I've been going to English Language Institute classes because
mm-hmm.
those are students that are new on campus. They're
mm-hmm.
new to the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they face unique challenges.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of mentors who are bilingual. And a lot of those students, and just students in general, don't feel comfortable going to an advisor or counselor or
mm-hmm.
even their instructor.
Mm-hmm.
They feel more comfortable going to a fellow student.
Yes.
And
yes.
So that's what we're trying to make the program accessible for, any student that just wants another student to talk to who
mm-hmm.
can tell them about all the resources on campus.
Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
these students don't know what they don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
so true.
Yeah.
So true.
So my mentors go through at least 6 hours of formal training right
mm-hmm.
at the beginning of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
I've created this handbook
mm-hmm.
for them.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about everything from how diverse our campus is,
mm-hmm.
How we have to be open and not just open, but eager to talk with and embrace people from different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to be really excited about working with people
yeah.
of different
mm-hmm.
backgrounds, and
mm-hmm.
My mentors they all embrace that,
mm-hmm.
so that's a great aspect of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do a lot of developing effective mentoring skills, which
mm-hmm.
includes listening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we live in an age where people are bombarded with the 24-hour news cycle, and we forget to listen to people when they're speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So they go through a lot of training. They learn about the academic resources on campus,
mm-hmm.
the student support services,
mm-hmm.
and campus life.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, they're in a position to help connect mentees with the resources they need.
Mm-hmm.
Some mentees don't know that we have tutors for many, many different subjects.
Yeah.
Or that the CIS 100 tutors are in a different building.
Uh-huh.
And that our student support services can offer a lot of different types of support.
Yeah.
Or that the counselors here can work with students on, you know, everything, not just course selection or figuring out a program of study,
mm-hmm.
but also personal problems. And so the mentors can really be a bridge between the students and the resources they need.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually their main function.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we're trying to do just a drop-in on Tuesdays and Wednesdays for any student who has questions. Just come and talk to a mentor, and then I'm always here. So I'm a counselor as well. So, you know, the mentors are not counselors. They're not advisors. They're just the liaison between the student and the resources they need. So if I could reach every student on a campus, the new students coming in, because mentees, students on campus, they need to take advantage of the resources. I think this really, really successful students are the ones that use all the resources.
So would you say that Inside Track is like the first step to like really getting help and finding like exactly who you need to help you?
Well, for a lot of students it is. I'll use an example. Today, one of the students from ELI came in. And she's from overseas, and she is in the Computer Information Systems Associate Program. She's not, hasn't started it yet because she has to finish all her ELI and English 93. But she came in wanting to know, you know, if she should do that program, the CIS program, if she will be able to find a job, or if she should do nursing. And she has all these questions, and she's wanting to make, like, a major, major decision right now. And so we were able to talk with her and break it down into very incremental steps that she needs to take. One, continue working on your English. Two, focus on the next level English class. I think it's English 93. Take your math placement exam. Get into CIS 100. Because there are certain classes like CIS 100 and the English that are good for both programs that she's considering. And so it's like, don't even bother making a decision right now that's going to affect you for the rest of your life. Just take these steps, these little incremental steps to get you to where you need to be in terms of fluency. And in the meantime, be exploring your program options. Look at our website. Explore your program. Well, let me say this. The students we do reach, we have a very good retention rate from semester to semester. Like, for example, last semester, 77% of the mentees in the program enrolled for the winter semester. That's pretty good, 77%. So we like to think that just having this connection with the campus is contributing to their academic performance and, you know, just knowing they have a support system on campus.
Okay. So do the mentors, like, when they're suggesting classes, like...
Oh, mentors do not suggest
classes. They don't? Okay, okay.
Mentors, they can talk about classes. They can definitely say, you know, I took this professor for this class, and I had a good experience. But in terms of selecting classes for their program, they come to me.
Okay, cool.
And I can talk to them. So they have, that's the other thing, mentees have a direct access to a counselor through the mentors. So on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, I'm here, just walk in and talk to a counselor, and I can help you out.
Okay, I have another question. So does Dr. Webster, if students are on academic probation, do they go to Dr. Webster first, and then does she?
They come to any counselor.
Okay. Are you notified of that beforehand?
Oh, when they sign up, when they schedule an appointment, there's a list of reasons they're coming to see a counselor. So it could be academic advising, career exploration, academic probation.
So different reasons would take you to different counselors?
No, all the counselors are licensed professional counselors, so we can work with the student on all those issues.
So
the advisors and the Welcome Center don't really handle personal issues. The University of Michigan Ann Arbor has 32 mentoring programs. They are proven to contribute to academic success and retention. Through a mentoring program, a mentee can feel more connected with the campus. And students that are more connected with their campus are more likely to stay.
I'm Olivia Grant. I'm staff writer for the Mirror News.
Thank you, Olivia, for that great series of interviews about student services here at Henry Ford College. This is Justin Randles with the Mirror News Now, broadcasting from Henry Ford College. We'll be back in just a moment.
1 in 3 adults in America have pre-diabetes, but most don't know it. To let people know it can be reversed before it becomes type 2 diabetes, professional basketball player Julius Randle is doing everything in reverse.
I'm only dunking with reverse windmills. I drove the whole way to practice in reverse. I don't recommend it. This move's called the reverse shuffle. I do recommend it. And it took me months to learn how to speak in reverse, like this. Here's 10 almost for diabetes type 2 with living Ben has mom my. In other words, my mom has been living with type 2 diabetes for almost 10 years. So together, we want to say to the 84 million Americans at risk, exercise and healthy eating can help reverse prediabetes. Start by taking a simple one-minute risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Bet he can't say that in reverse.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. So glad to be with you this Friday afternoon and also to be with Justin Randles from the HFC Mirror News, the student newspaper, as we present another edition of Mirror News Now. Justin is the creative editor of the paper and also a student here at Henry Ford College. And it's been a great experience in the last few months starting this collaboration up so that all of our journalists who work in a print format can also work in a multimedia format and have their stories have a life above and beyond the print, and also a podcast which is available through the HFC Mirror News website. We're going to wrap up and conclude today's edition of the WHFR Journal featuring the Mirror News with one last segment. Justin Randles is here to tell us all about it.
This is Justin Randles with the Mirror News Now, broadcasting from Henry Ford College. Let's turn now to Jesse Maddox, who interviewed Henry Ford College instructor of American Sign Language, Jennifer Stewart.
So you started working at Henry Ford College in August of 2015. Could you maybe share a little bit about your background in American Sign Language, your experiences, or your inspiration? You're very passionate about teaching, and I would love to share that with the listeners.
Sure. I grew up in two worlds, the deaf and hearing world. My father, David Stewart, was very prominent in the deaf community. He wrote educational books for learning ASL and teaching deaf students. He was also head of the education department at Michigan State University. He was lead professor of deaf education there. His influences spread throughout the country and even the world. He was involved with every aspect of the deaf community and educating people about it. So basically, I was born into this profession, growing up with my father being deaf and educating people about his deafness led me to where I am today. I used to hang out with his deaf friends and my other deaf family members. I was able to gain perspective that I never thought I would have otherwise just by attending school. I feel as though I need to continue his legacy and teach with the passion he had for his own language and culture. So this position that I have here at Henry Ford College means the world to me, and I want to continue to inspire my students to follow their passions as well.
And now with ASL, there are some common misconceptions or assumptions that are typically made. What might people be surprised to learn?
One of the shocking discoveries for my new ASL students is that American Sign Language is an actual language. It's not just hand gestures. It is an actual language, and even furthermore, it's the third most commonly used language here in the United States. It is not just signing matching English words or sentences. It has its own grammatical structure. It's made up of mouth movements, facial expressions, body gestures, and everything is proven by a linguist named Dr. William Stokey, who has, in fact, proven it is a language, and that's why we offer it here at the college as part of the World Languages Department.
Now, as part of the program, I've noticed how much it's grown over the past few years. Would you maybe like to talk a little bit about that? How much has this program grown in your eyes?
Yes, exponentially. We are so proud. We have one of the fastest growing programs here at the college. Last time I checked, we had over 200 students currently taking American Sign Language classes. I don't know what we're at for this year, but I can only assume it has grown. We also have an American Sign Language Club, which gives back to the deaf community and hosts community deaf events to spread awareness, help inclusion, and teaches the language of ASL.
Where do you see this program in a few more years down the line?
Growing. It's only becoming more and more popular. We have high hopes that our students will be successful and become excellent interpreters that serve the deaf community well.
And then lastly, this program has impacted the campuses and changed students' lives. But how has it changed your own?
Well, this program gives me purpose. I wake up happy and ready to do what I believe in and what I'm meant to do with my life. More importantly, we're hoping to train ASL interpreters to serve the deaf community in a positive manner and in a way that the deaf community deserve to be served. I love my job, and I love teaching here at Henry Ford College.
Now, is there any last thing you would like to say to your listeners before we wrap it up today?
Sign up for ASL classes today. I cannot wait to see you in my class.
All right, perfect. Well, hopefully we'll get a few friendly faces in there, but either way, thank you for this interview. It's been amazing speaking with you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course.
That is it for this edition of Mirror News Now, broadcasting from Henry Ford Campus. A special thank you to Alan Mazurek and staff writers Madison Fetterman, Olivia Grantham, and Jesse Maddox. This wraps up the winter semester edition of the Mirror News Now. Enjoy the warmer weather and be on the lookout for the spring-summer edition of the Mirror News Now. This is Justin Randles. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Justin. That wraps up today's edition of the WHFR Journal, our collaboration with HFC's Mirror News, bringing you Mirror News Now. We look forward to continuing this in the months ahead, certainly in the fall semester, but who knows, maybe we'll have them back for that spring-summer edition as well. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thank you so much for listening to the WHFR Journal here on WHFR 89.3. We've got Kitty Love coming up next to take us on a trip down Highway 61.
Sunset in New Mexico.
Each week, I'm right from the underground. I spotlight
mountains coming
we'll cross genres
like
and you can hear the widest variety of music. I'm your host, Bill Keith, and I enjoy digging through all the new releases we've received to find the best new music for you. Some of the artists you'll hear include iconic artists like Robert Plant, local favorites like the Appleseed Collective, and lesser-known songwriters like Damian Jurado.
So
we're so fortunate that Henry Ford College
know,
has made it possible for WHFR.FM. Their investment allows us to continue digging deep to find you the best new music. Check out Light from the Underground on the 2nd and 4th Saturdays
give
at 10 a.m. on 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're making waves.
Winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award, this is W.
And this is Highway 61. You're listening to WHFR. Dearborn, we are Henry Ford College's radio station, and I'm having a little bleed through on something I just downloaded, and I'm trying to get rid of that in the background, but we were listening to one of the songs that we are going to hear in a little bit, and I got to do some rewinding here to get you all ready for this next show coming up, Highway 61 with DJ Kitty Love, that's me, and a little snafu to start the show here, and I do believe that I figured it out, and hopefully we'll have the rest of this here for you coming up really short here. And I'm probably going to have to redo this whole thing, but usually it goes a lot smoother. I'm DJ Kitty Love, and we're trying to get some things real ready to roll for the Highway 61.